Welcome to episode 3 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode is a dialogue on Israel and Palestine with Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein. The talk was moderated by Paul Jay of the Real News Network and took place at the 2016 Left Forum in New York City. You can find a video of the entire talk, as well as other panels from the Left Forum, on my blog, othervoicesotherchoices.com, and on the YouTube channel of the same name.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Paul Jay, and I'm with the Real News Network. Prime Minister Netanyahu recently appointed, as I'm sure most people know, Avigdor Lieberman as his defense minister. He seemed very unconcerned how this might affect American public opinion or how it might affect a $10 billion weapons package that's being negotiated. And why should he be concerned? The American media is the one that delivers this news to the American people and continues the narrative that Israel is the victim in all of this, so of course they need $10 billion of weapons. The point here is that it's an extremely dangerous moment for the Palestinian people. The need for a South African-style broad front solidarity movement against Israeli occupation in support of the Palestinian people is even more urgent. So that's what I hope we end up discussing today, how to develop that broad front so we leave here with something to do about it. But in order to get into that conversation, first some background from our two guests who are eminently qualified to give us such background. First of all, Norman Finkelstein. He's one of the foremost scholars of Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's written about a dozen books on many topics, including U.S. foreign policy towards Israel, the use and abuse of the history of the Holocaust, and Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence. His controversial legacy as an academic was made into an award-winning documentary film, American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. Tariq Ali is a writer and filmmaker. He's written more than 24 books on world history and politics and several novels, translated into over a dozen languages, as well as scripts for the stage and screen. He's editor of New Left Review and contributes to The Guardian, Counterpunch, the London Review of Books, and thank you and help me welcome them. So my first question is for Tariq. A few weeks ago, an Israeli general compared the fascistization of Israeli society to 1930s Nazi Germany. Talk about that process.
Well, it's good that it came from the mouth of an Israeli general, because if any of us had said it, we'd have been accused of being anti-Semitic or self-hating Jews or whatever other names they call those who criticize Israel rationally. The fact that it was the general, the deputy commander-in-chief of the Israeli Defense Force, who said it, did create a certain propaganda crisis for them. He was denounced by Netanyahu himself, but I think the words got home. People began to think that the situation in Israel is getting worse and worse. And this came after a number of events in Israel. The arrest of a soldier for killing a Palestinian, mass mobilizations in favor of that soldier, support for that soldier from many elements within Likud and the extreme right in Israeli politics, the fact that within Israel itself, the Palestinians are no longer regarded by a vast majority, not just by a small extremist minority, but by a large majority of the population as something not worth bothering about. And it's this that is worrying certain people inside the Israeli establishment itself. I don't know how many of you saw a documentary some years ago called The Gatekeepers, which was statements by people out of power, when it's much easier to say these things, about how every single Israeli policy in relation to the Palestinians had been a disaster or had failed, and how they had done bad things. This is a serving general inside the Israeli army who is saying this, and it's already, I think, partially Netanyahu wanted to punish him by openly speculating that he was going to appoint Lieberman defense minister, i.e. putting this extremely nutty semi-fascist in charge of the Israeli Defense Force, and the serving defense minister has now resigned, saying that this is unacceptable. These are all people inside Likud or on its fringes. So what this indicates to me is, you know, that it's not just that the occupation of Palestine has been horrific for the Palestinian people, but we now have very clear evidence that the occupation of Palestinian lands by the Israeli establishment and by all political parties in power since 1948 is proving to be extremely bad for a majority of Israelis as well, even though they don't seem to recognize the fact just yet. But some of the more intelligent elements inside the Israeli establishment do recognize it and feel unless some stop is put to this, it's going to end badly.
Norman, Avigdor Lieberman is someone who actually proposed ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Israel. He actually redrew the map and was taking Palestinian villages and areas and putting them into occupied territories, taking back land. Why do you think it is that Netanyahu is so confident of his position that the appointment of Lieberman isn't going to affect the arms deal and generally affect his, the positioning right now in terms of the elections?
I think one has to begin with the fact that coming next year, we'll be hitting the 50th anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and West Bank including East Jerusalem and Gaza. That means, roughly speaking, two and a half generations of Israelis have lived with, and not just lived with, but been active participations in the occupation. And the bottom line is, Israel is a small place. Its population now, I saw the most recent statistic, is about 8.3 million people, which is roughly the size of New York. And the population under occupation is about 4 million people. In order to occupy such a large number of people, relatively speaking, to your own population, even with the Palestinian Authority, it still requires virtually, if not literally, aside from those who are allowed to skip army service for religious reasons, it's virtually every single Israeli at this point has been an active participation in a quite brutal occupation. If you look at the histories now written, even the torture of Palestinians, the use of torture against Palestinian detainees, it begins right after the occupation begins. It then reaches a peak during the First Intifada, when Human Rights Watch estimated that tens of thousands of Palestinian detainees were tortured or suffered ill treatment. And leaving aside the torture, the demolition of homes, which was quite pervasive up until a Supreme Court decision, which to some extent diminished it, the point is that a large part of Israeli society has been and had to be, given the roles they were playing, had to be brutalized and to a large extent, inured to the kinds of brutality they were visiting on the Palestinian population. If you don't understand that and you detach Israeli society from what goes on at the leadership level, then you really don't, I think, understand what's going on. Because it's a whole society with a certain small number of exceptions. It's a whole society that's just gone over the cliff. If you want to understand Israeli society, the easiest way to grasp it is to look at the documentaries of our own civil rights movement and look at the folks, the white folks in the American South. It's that kind of brutalization that's occurred across Israeli society. And that's unusual. Now, it's no doubt true the United States as a state, as a government, it engages in mass atrocities and brutalities across the planet. But it's a relatively small number of Americans who are actual participants in those acts. That's not true in Israel. Even if you take a figure who's very popular in the United States, he's a kind of strange version of what we used to call a court Jew, namely Jeffrey Goldberg. He plays this kind of strange court Jew, tough Jew role. But if you take a person like Jeffrey Goldberg, who's a mainstream American figure, and in the media, he's looked upon as some sort of representative of American Jewry at its proudest moment. If you read his memoir, Prisoners, he was a prison guard, and he was part of the conveyor belt of torture. He was freely admitting to it. He would bring prisoners to what was called the refrigerator. It's the size of a refrigerator where they put people in for a couple of days. You can use your imagination. Even people like Jeffrey Goldberg, who was a volunteer from the United States, he himself became part of the conveyor belt. And so it's a whole society, including Jeffrey Goldberg, as an example, including American Jews, who went over, who brutalized and then became inured to that brutality. And so for Israelis, doesn't really make much difference what maniac happens to be in power. If you look at all of the Israeli assaults on Gaza during Defensive Shield in 2002 in the West Bank, in Lebanon, if you look at the public opinion polls, in every single case, at least 92%, and sometimes as high as 95% of the Israeli population supported those assaults. Basically, they were just massacres. There was, except for the case of Lebanon, there was no war to speak of. And that enjoyed overwhelming support. Now, if you look in the last couple of days, who are the people in Israeli society who are, quote unquote, sounding the warning about the potential fascistization of Israeli society? Let's leave aside for a moment the deputy commander whose background I'm not familiar with. The most prominent person right now is the ex-defense minister, Ya'alon. Now, he quit, he said, because of disturbing tendencies in Israeli society, doesn't want to be part of them. Who was Ya'alon? Ya'alon was the defense minister during Operation Protective Edge. If you read Aluf Ben, who's the senior military correspondent for Haaretz, he says, why was Ya'alon shook up? He said, in 2015, when the Duma family child, the one-year-old, was torched, he was very upset. And then the turning point for him was the killing of the wounded Palestinian by the Israeli soldier. What happened during Protective Edge? 550 children were killed, not one. If you read the descriptions in like the UN report on Gaza, which was a dreadful report, it was presided over by a New York State judge, Mary McGowan Davis, you can fill in the rest, you can figure it out. The kids, their body parts were flung everywhere. Children, they have an arm on one roof, an arm on another roof, torsos which couldn't be identified. 19,000 homes were destroyed. But let's be clear, it wasn't destruction as in quote-unquote collateral damage. If you read the Breaking the Silence testimonies, they talk about they went into areas, marked off the areas, systematically laid waste, razed the homes. Now, you know here, like myself, if your computer overloads, or even in my case last night, my keyboard wasn't working, I enter into a panic. I call up everyone I know in the earliest hours of the morning. We have a crisis. There's a crisis. My keyboard doesn't work. But then, Gaza consists 80% of refugees and descendants of refugees. Over 50% are children. And now you have this army of Israeli citizens. These are ordinary people. Do you know what it means to destroy someone's home? You go into the bedroom, you see the kids' playthings, you go into the closets, the drawers. Do you know what it takes, the kind of mentality it requires to do that? And that explains why Israel, in my opinion, has gone over the cliff. The idea that Yah alone would be traumatized by the killing of one kid, or even take the next one who's traumatized. We read today, Ehud Barak is traumatized. He thinks there are ugly tendencies at play. Ehud Barak, it's already forgotten. This whole cycle, the whole cycle of the last 16 years, it began with him, with the fake claim that he made a big offer at Camp David, which was then endorsed by that monster who happens to be married to the other monster. And actually, it convinced a lot of Israelis. I know many Israelis who were completely convinced that a great offer was given them, the Palestinians. They turned it down. There's no one to negotiate with. What was the next thing Ehud Barak did? On September 29th, 2000, the Second Intifada began. He was the one that gave the order, it has to be mercilessly crushed immediately. For those whose memories go back, before the suicide bombers, the suicide bombing didn't begin until March 2nd, 2001. The actual First Intifada, it began on September 29th, 2000. 5 months elapsed before that first suicide bombing. Who created that situation? It was Barak. Within 3 to 4 days, 1 million rounds of ammunition were fired at the Palestinians. As one Israeli put it, one for every Palestinian child. That was Barak. And it was because of him, the Second Intifada, for those who remember before the suicide bombings, because that's all we're told about, the Second Intifada started out nonviolently. It was the same mass demonstrations as in the First Intifada. But then with the brutality, the ratio was 20 Palestinians killed for each Israeli killed in the first 3 weeks. It was just a bloodletting. So when I hear Barak and Yah alone are worried by this sudden appearance in Israeli society of fascism, you have to take it with a big boulder of salt. I'm going to stop here because Paul said you can answer at length. I was once told when I was debating in Canada, they said the wrong thing to a Brooklyn Jew. They said, be aggressive. I don't want to tell you what happened.
Okay, I was in Beirut in 2012, and I interviewed a young girl. She was about 14, 15 years old, in a Palestinian refugee camp. And I asked her, what would you say to Israeli kids your own age? She said, I'd like to strangle them with my bare hands around their neck. And I said, why? And she said, because I saw on Israeli television when they were bombing Gaza, kids were writing their names on the bombs about to be dropped. And that mainstream Israeli TV showing this. So this hatred, the anger in these kids for what they've experienced, lived, and witnessed, and seen, does not seem right now to have a way to express itself in a way that's going to be liberating for the Palestinian people. So where are we at in terms of the response of Palestinians now?
Well, I think if we are brutally honest, we have to say that the Palestinian organizations, especially the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which negotiated the Oslo Accords, has participated and collaborated in the defeat that has been inflicted on the Palestinian people. I think this collaboration was absolutely vital for the Israelis in order to do what they are now doing. And I think the debate and discussion that has now opened up, even within the PLO, is an indication that everyone now knows, there's no secret, not that they didn't know it before, that this is the way they were going. And for a long time it was difficult to say it. I mean, I've been saying it for 10, 15 years in different parts of the world, including at conferences organized by Palestinians themselves. And in private, a lot of them would agree, you're right, but we can't say it in public. I said, you have to say it in public. It shouldn't be left to people like me to say it. You have to say it. Because saying it will be helpful and will not allow the people to get too demoralized. If no one opens their mouths from within the leadership or lower echelons or lower ranking cadres of that organization, we're sunk. And in fact, as we know, the scale of the collaboration was huge. Of the money given to the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian Authority, which was Palestinian but which had no authority at all, because never was there a Palestinian authority. From the beginning, the real authority was the IDF, and behind it, the Israeli government, and behind it, the White House and the State Department, i.e. the United States of America. So there was never any Palestinian authority. What they had was a budget. Billions came in. A majority segment of this budget was spent on what? Security. Let's see what is meant by security. Defending the Palestinian people against the onslaughts of the IDF? No, perish the thought. The security they talked about was to keep their own people under control and to deal with rival factions of Palestinians in Gaza, etc. That's what the bulk of the money was spent on. Where did some of the rest of the money go? It went in enriching those who were organizing this so-called Palestinian Authority. Political leaders, including right at the very top, low-level cadres, they were bought off and told, we've struggled enough, let's enjoy life for a bit. But, you know, we're all in favor of enjoying life for a bit if your own people aren't living in such dire and desperate conditions. And this is what was completely ignored. And, you know, I have a very dear friend, a Palestinian poet who lives in Cairo, who told me when I went to Ramallah, a close friend of mine, we had fought together in the old days, took me up the mountain and showed me his brand new villa, which must have cost God knows, you know, $500,000 or the equivalent thereof. And he said, look, this is how I live now, and I'm happy. And he said, I felt like slapping his face, because not so far away were people who were living in really appalling conditions. And this money, which could have been used to aid every Palestinian family, to build schools, to build small clinics, etc., etc., was frittered away. And the Israelis knew what they were doing. They were buying off the top layers of Palestinian society within the PLO. And we have now reached a situation where I was at a conference in Spain, in Cordoba, a few weeks ago, sharing a platform with the Palestinian Minister for Finance and Economics. And everything I've said to you, I said to his face. And he admitted, he said, yeah, perhaps we spent too much on security. And I said, what about the 2 billion bribe scandal? And he said, that's exaggerated. No open denial. It's a huge tragedy that the leaders of a movement could be bought off and bought off so easily. So he then turned to me and said, well, what would you do? I said, for one thing, what I would do now, really, because enough is enough, is say to the world at large, there is no authority, there is no Palestinian authority, we're going to dump it, it doesn't exist. We are just Palestinians in this region which is occupied by Israel, and dear world and dear people in the world, that's what we are. Are you going to help us? Please do. If not, we'll struggle on and live together and share each other's goods and money as long as we can, because that is what is needed. And he said, well, there's a logic in what you say. But I said, the logic, if it exists for you, has come too bloody late for the Palestinian people. They know what you've done. The Israelis do horrific things, as Norman has eloquently described and has been describing for years. But I said, being defeated by your own leadership is psychologically and politically very damning. That is much more difficult to get over, because you then say, what alternative do we have? Where are we going? So I say that as long as this is recognized, and they are beginning to recognize it, it's difficult not to, that they have lost the battle for a Palestinian state. That Palestinian state which they dreamed of, even on the 67 frontiers, is not going to happen, because the occupation settlements have just encroached too far into Palestinian territory. There is no Israeli government which is going to remove them, because it won't have the support of its own population to do so. The United States is indifferent, always has been indifferent to the fate of the Palestinians, and more so after the 67 war. So there's going to be no help from the so-called international community, by which is just a code word for referring to the United States. So in this situation, far better that the Palestinians acknowledge their situation and then see how to proceed forward. The situation is grim. It's pointless prettifying it or finding hope in tiny things. Not that these tiny things are not important. The BDS campaign is important. It's important not because it'll bring down the Israeli government. That is an illusion, that it will bring down the Israeli government. The South African government was not brought down by sanctions. It was brought down by the defeat inflicted by the Cuban army on South Africa.
You're listening to Episode 3 of the Other Voices, Other Choices series. This episode is a dialogue on Israel and Palestine with Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein, and is a panel from the 2016 Left Forum. The moderator is Paul Jay of the Real News Network.
But sanctions on their own are never decisive. I nonetheless support them. Why? Because it is an important way to project what is going on in the world of Israel and Palestine and in the world at large. And on that front, it's been effective. The reason the Israeli government is so hostile to it is not that they feel threatened by the sanctions, but because it disgraces them. It shames them. They have to answer questions about it. When campuses in the United States or parts of Europe stand up and say, we demand a boycott of Israel, it shames even the American government, which finds this horrifying, and European governments, which have done absolutely nothing to aid the Palestinians. So these movements, societal movements from below, are extremely important from that particular vantage point, and that's why I was a signatory to it from the beginning, without any illusions, but understanding its importance. And this is why now there's a huge campaign. They've outlawed BDS in France, which, by the way, is the most pro-Israeli country in Europe today. And the appointment of Mark Negev, a friend of Netanyahu's and formerly Netanyahu's press officer, who you probably saw complacent and unctuous on television screens defending the indefensible, is now the ambassador in London to see if he can persuade the conservative government to do what the French have done and make BDS activities illegal. And allied to this comes a new campaign, which is not new, of course, in the United States, but is new in large parts of Europe, whereby the chief rabbi in Britain said there is no such thing as anti-Zionism that is not also anti-Semitism, and said that anti-Zionism, people who talk about anti-Zionism, are anti-Semitic. Of course, liberal Jews and the Jewish Voices for Peace, thankfully there are many more of these still in British society than the other, came out very strongly denouncing this. So there is a debate going on, and you ask yourself, why is it that suddenly this campaign of anti-Semitism got sparked off in Britain? That's because the Labour Party, to its own horror and shock, has elected a leader who is very well known for being a defender of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian movement. And it is this that has panicked them. So they're denouncing people in his circles, etc. Sometimes Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, says something which is three quarters accurate but not 100%, and says it in a temper without rationally arguing it. So they pounce on him. Or another member of parliament who 2 years ago forwarded one of Norm's texts and satirical blogs saying that all the Israeli Jews could, of course, come back and live in the United States if they want to, since many of them went from Brooklyn and so whatever. So this is so obviously a satirical blog, and she found it amusing and forwarded it. She's been accused of anti-Semitism. Because she was foolish. Instead of saying this is a blog by Norman Finkelstein, I forwarded, then they could deal with Norman directly. But instead, she panicked and apologized and went on her knees. They've still suspended her from the Labour Party. Because the worst thing to do in these situations is not to fight back. If you don't fight back, they carry on and on and on. So this is what's going on. And you know, the irony of the situation is that if you want to know the community in Europe which is really suffering, it is the Muslim communities. Yeah. There is a huge wave of Islamophobia in many parts of Europe. I would say virtually all of Europe, which in its manifestations is not that different from the attacks that were made on Jewish people in the 20s and 30s and even in the 40s and even in the 50s after the Second World War. A lot of the arguments being used against Muslims are very similar. Someone has actually done an analysis of what was written about the Jews and what is being written about the Muslims. Almost exactly the same. And yet, does anyone care? No, well, we do. But by and large, this is completely ignored because the media is a part of it. So that is the situation that we confront, and of course, you know, we fight it back. But the Palestinians have to understand, and I think increasingly they do, that the state they visualized is impossible. So the only hope, I can't see any other way out, is a solution which many staunch Israeli anti-Zionists from the Matzpen group and others have defended for a long time. And many of them educated me in this whole idea about 40 years ago, that the only viable long-term solution is a single Israeli-Palestinian state with equal rights for Jews, Muslims, Christians, Palestinians, Druids, whatever.
So, Norman, I'm going to ask you to respond to Tariq. There's sort of two big points here. There really is no two-state solution left to be had, and it's now a one-state issue. And then I'm going to ask Norman to respond on the BDS question, the whole issue of sanctions.
I hope that Paul won't be offended, but I feel like the one-state, two-state has been argued to the point of tedium. And I want to make some other remarks, and if we have time, I'll come back to that, if that's okay.
Sure.
I want to begin with the question that Paul, or the scenario, or the interview that Paul had in Lebanon with this young woman who wanted to strangle the Israeli children, young Israeli Palestinian child who wanted to strangle the Israeli children. And it conjures up an image of this seething anger and brutality on both sides, and how the conflict has corrupted both sides. And I think there's a certain amount of it creates a picture which is highly distorted and inaccurate. I find, and I don't say this in any kind of malice, I've passed the age in my life where I have to vent my anger, inner anger or malice towards other people. I try to be as objective as I can when it comes to the politics. So I'm not saying it in malice, but I don't think there is a rational basis for this Israeli seething anger at Palestinians. If you look at what actually happens during these conflicts, say, between Israel and Gaza, the balance sheet is so wildly imbalanced that the notion that both sides suffer or both sides have comparable grievances is simply preposterous. And during Operation Protective Edge, one Israeli house was destroyed. 19,000 Palestinian homes were destroyed. One Israeli child was killed. 550 Palestinian children were killed. 20,000 tons. 20,000 tons of explosives were dropped on Gaza. At the outside, maybe 40 tons were dropped in Israel from these Gaza fireworks. There was no war. There was some fighting inside Gaza, which unprecedentedly, it cost the lives of 67 Israeli soldiers. That was unusual, mostly because of the effectiveness of the tunnel system they had created. But that aside, you take a place like Shujaya, 90,000 people crammed into this tiny area. Israel dropped more than 100 one-ton bombs. More than 100 one-ton bombs on Shujaya. How can anyone in his or her right mind compare that remotely to what happens in Israel? I'll admit, before I say it, there's an element of hyperbole. I'll admit there's an element of exaggeration. However, it's not so wildly exaggerated to say that I face more danger on the boardwalk of Coney Island on July 4th than 99% of Israelis face during these wars with Gaza. Those are fireworks. They are not rockets. They are not missiles. As a matter of fact, I met a Gazan who told me in Gaza they call them belly dancers because they swivel when they go up into the air. Everybody knows they are a joke. Now, let me now turn to the question of what's possible. What can be done about an appalling situation? There have been two, or I should say, in the history of the Palestinian struggle, there have been basically three strategies that have been tried. One, everybody's familiar with, the diplomacy, which begins technically in 1993 with the Oslo Agreement. There's no point in squandering precious time trying to demonstrate to you that it's failed. It manifestly has failed. When the Oslo Agreement was signed, there were about 250,000 illegal Jewish settlers in the occupied Palestinian territories. Now there are about 600,000. If you judge an agreement not by its verbal claims, but by its actual outcomes, Oslo was not a peace process, it was an annexation process. The goal was to annex the most desirable parts of the West Bank, and that process unfolded with a certain kind of methodicalness over the past 20, 25 years. Diplomacy is a dead end. The other strategy practiced right now has been the armed struggle, the armed resistance of Hamas. Now, under international law, Hamas, the Palestinians, nothing in international law debars them from using armed force to end the occupation. That is, let's put it, I won't use the technical language because I'm on tape and then people are going to try to get to me. Nothing under international law debars them from using armed force to end the occupation. For me, that's not an important question. Legally, they have the right. Morally, in my opinion, they have the right. But then there's the political question. The political question is very simple. Does it work? Is it working? Is it a viable strategy? So let's set aside the legal question, where I think Palestinians have the right. The moral question, I think they have the right. But then let's look at the political question. Does it work? Does it have the potential of working? You judge for yourself. Since 2008-09, since Operation Cast Lead, there have been three Israeli operations, really massacres, though the second one wasn't quite on the same level. Operation Cast Lead, Operation Pillar of Defense in November 2012, and then Operation Protective Edge. Each time Hamas went to battle with Israel, each time they set the same goal, always the same, to end the blockade of Gaza. That was the goal. we want to end the blockade of Gaza. Each time, at the end, there was some sort of promise or commitment to ending the blockade. We're now in 2016, 2 years after Protective Edge. Was the blockade lifted? It's not working. The strategy doesn't work. There's a kind of mutual gain by both sides in pretending that there's such thing as armed resistance. So Hamas says, look, our rockets work. The Israelis are so afraid of them. So they get to say armed resistance is working. Then the Israelis say, they're attacking us with rockets. What do you expect us to do? Or as Mr. Obama likes to say, that they have the right to defend themselves. It was my two daughters. What would I expect? You know, stupefying narcissist. So both sides have a stake in pretending this thing called armed resistance works. It does not. And then you have to ask yourself, what's left? And there is, in the history of the Palestinian movement, there is the third option, which was remarkably successful. And that was the mass nonviolent resistance of the First Intifada. Most people are much too young here to remember, but it was a remarkably successful mass uprising which hurt Israel at two fundamental levels. Number one, disaster for Israel in terms of public relations. Kids with stones, and then Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin issues an order. It was called a force, might, and beatings. And then the Israeli army went around and systematically broke the bones of Palestinian children. That didn't do great on the news internationally. It was a disaster for Israel, for those who remember. And secondly, it was a disaster for Israel because huge numbers of Israelis had to be called up, reservists, 500,000 at a time, in order to put down the uprising. The nonviolence resistance, in general, as a tactic, it has real possibilities. The question is, now what to do? In my opinion, there is a real possibility now. One of the paradoxes of the Israel-Palestine conflict is, objectively, in fact, things have never looked better, aside from the fact that other parts of the Arab world are now getting a huge amount of attention, which never before happened. Syria, Iraq, I don't have to go through it with you. And that steals the camera from the Palestinians. But aside from that development, which I recognize is not trivial, it's never been better. Objectively, a huge amount of public opinion now is ready to put pressure on Israel. An even huger amount of public opinion in Europe is now ready to put pressure on Israel. The challenge in politics, I know Tariq doesn't like him, and I don't care. The challenge in politics is what Gandhi always said is, it's how do you get people to act? How do you get people to act on what they already know is wrong? Politics is not about, as people in my generation used to say, and probably Tariq still says, it's not about trying to raise people's consciousness, because everybody knows 1,000 things are already wrong. Yeah. The question is how to get them to act on what they already know is wrong. And that was the genius of the Bernie Sanders campaign. He didn't try to raise anybody's consciousness. He just started to say things that everybody's been thinking every minute of every day. I can't pay my loans. I can't find a job. I can't move out of my parents' home. I can't. And all of a sudden, Bernie started to say what people already knew was wrong. That's the challenge. How to get them to act on what they already know is wrong. And there is a real possibility here. The way you get people to act, Gandhi said, is you engage in mass nonviolent resistance, and you may think it doesn't sound like a profound revolutionary text. He says you have to be willing to get your bones broken to evoke people's pity and sympathy. That's how you get people to act. Now, it may not sound so profound, but for those of you who lived during the civil rights movement, what got people to act? When they saw dogs, the dogs on the kids. When they saw the water cannons on the kids. When you saw some volunteers getting killed. When you saw Emmett Till and you saw what happened to his face. That's what gets people to act. People think Gandhi's nonviolence was, about, Om and if you planning to go to San Francisco, make sure to have a flower in your hair. No, that wasn't Gandhi. If you read Gandhi, he says, if you want to be serious, you got to get your bones broken. You got to get your skull cracked. You got to get yourself killed. That's what he said nonviolence is about. If you read him, the real Gandhi, it's almost a kind of cult of death. But it's not like he's worshiping death. He's kind of realistic about what gets people to act. What gets people to move, to go from knowing something is wrong to actually doing something about it. Where are we at now? As I said, there have been major changes in public opinion. And then you have to find the right target. I know Tarek, his innards are probably writhing now, but Gandhi was very shrewd with the Salt March because he picked a target that affected everyone in Indian society but hurt the poor the most. It was a very clever target. It affected everyone, the salt tax, but of course it hurt the poor the most. What do we have now? There is something. It's the blockade of Gaza. It's a realistic goal. It is a realistic goal. I'll say it 10,000 times, and I am not Pollyannish. It's a realistic goal to end the blockade. Bernie Sanders, he made a point during his major interview, the blockade has to be lifted. That means we have Bernie on our side, and that's not trivial. That means a large number of people, more than anyone in his human memory could possibly imagine, more than the anti-war movement. That's a fact. If you have Bernie saying the blockade has to be lifted. 2 days ago, Haaretz newspaper, I was surprised, had ran an editorial, the blockade has to be lifted. It said, all this talk about we need it for security reasons, that's BS. Haaretz said it, of course, didn't say BS. Then the UN commission, the UN inquiry in Gaza, horrible, horrible, horrible. Somehow somebody sneaked in the line. Mary McGowan Davis, she must have been snoozing. Someone sneaked in the line. It said the blockade of Gaza has to be lifted immediately and unconditionally. It was unbelievable. It didn't say it has to be lifted conditional on no arms being smuggled into Gaza. It didn't say it had to be lifted conditional on Hamas not using the cement to build tunnels. It said immediately and unconditionally. There is a realistic prospect, if we do things right, to at least, in the short term, end the blockade of Gaza. That's what I think the aim should be. June 5th, 2017, the half century of the occupation. It began 50 years ago, June 5th. It means we have 1 year to organize. I think it's a realistic goal, except for one thing. I said all the objective factors are there. The problem is the subjective factor, because we can't, and frankly, I don't know. I have mixed feelings. We shouldn't want to do it from here. It has to start there. Tariq says that South Africa was liberated because of the Cubans at Quito Carnaval. How is it pronounced? Quito Carvalho. I think it was first and foremost. I'm not going to downplay the role the Cubans played, but first and foremost, there was a mass movement in South Africa. In the absence of a mass movement, it's simply not realistic that you can, so to speak, liberate Palestine from the outside. And I don't even think it's very desirable to liberate from the outside, because if you do it from the outside, tomorrow the people will be just as powerless and a band of crooks will take over. Of course, I have mixed feelings because it's a brutal blockade. And getting that lifted anyway, you know, has to be done. So the problem is the people of Gaza. People of Gaza are hopeless. And the leadership, I know Hamas was never given a chance. I know from the day they won those parliamentary elections, the screws started being turned. Then the CIA was organizing the coup in 2007. I know all the details. And I recognize those details. But the fact of the matter is, Hamas now is terrible. It's very repressive, and it's just looking out for itself. It's, you know, in the history of all political movements, you have that mentality where you think that the survival of the struggle is synonymous with the survival of your group, and then you start just defending your group. I'm not going to bring it up here because now Tariq will gang me again, but that's sort of what happened with the Bolsheviks, where they began to think survival of the Bolsheviks was survival of the revolution, and the two were synonymous. And the same thing has now happened with Hamas. I talk a lot to the people in Gaza over Skype and things like that, and the level of despair is just, it's very hard to correct. But if we could show them that we're ready to do our all, in my opinion, if we're ready to do our all, if they're ready to do their all, then there's a realistic prospect for ending the blockade of Gaza. And I think it's a worthy goal.
You've been listening to episode 3 of the Other Voices, Other Choices series. This episode is a dialogue on Israel and Palestine with Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein. The talk was moderated by Paul Jay of the Real News Network and took place at the 2016 Left Forum in New York City. You can find a video of the entire talk, as well as other panels from the Left Forum, on my blog, othervoicesotherchoices.com, and on the YouTube channel of the same name. I'm Wilton Vaught. Thanks for listening.